This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. At the beginning of the century, Brooklyn was the destination for many immigrants coming to America. My guest, Vincent Schiavelli's family, emigrated from Sicily to that New York neighborhood, which they referred to as Bruculino. Schiavelli grew up there in the mid-50s, surrounded by an extended family. It was a tight-knit community, which he describes as having one foot in the mid-20th century and the other in mid-16th century Sicily. That's from Schiavelli's new book, Bruculino America, Remembrances of Sicilian-American Brooklyn Told in Stories and Recipes. His grandfather was a master chef, and food was the center of family life. Schiavelli has become an accomplished cook and has written extensively on Sicilian cuisine. He's also a character actor with a long, distinctive face. You may have seen him in Milos Forman's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, The People vs. Larry Flint, and Forman's early film, Taking Off. His other movies include Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Batman Returns, and last summer's James Bond flick, Tomorrow Never Dies. Here he is playing the evil Dr. Kaufman, threatening 007.
My name is Dr. Kaufman. I am an outstanding pistol marksman. Take my word for it, yeah?
It won't look like a suicide if you shoot me from over there.
I am a professor of forensic medicine. Believe me, Mr. Bond, I could shoot you from Stuttgart and still create the proper effect.
Vincent Schiavelli joins us on Fresh Air to talk about eating and acting. I asked him to describe a typical family meal growing up in Brooklyn.
Well, you know, in our house, as in many houses in the Bruculino of my growing up, food was edible culture. Really, we could not separate what we ate from who we were. And meals were very seasonally based, depending on the season. For example, if it were summer, if it were very warm, we would have wonderful salads with vinegar flavors that were very restorative and very refreshing. My grandfather made a wonderful tuna salad with olive oil and lemon and capers. At these dinners, there might be hard-boiled eggs draped with anchovies, or green bean salad with lots of vinegar. Those kinds of things would happen in the summer. In the wintertime, there would be sort of soups and stews and very warming things. It really was very seasonally based, but that meal was the place where we not only gathered around the table to eat, but where family members of different generations got to share the news of the day, got to share ideas, cross generations, and it kept everyone in touch with everybody else's lives.
So were these noisy affairs, lots of conversation around the kitchen table?
Lots of conversation. Of course, it got quiet while people were eating.
Right. But in between mouthfuls, then lots of talk.
In between mouthfuls, lots of talk. And it was sort of the rule that you really did talk, but you really didn't go to places that would create discord or indigestion.
Right. Now, your grandfather was a master chef, somebody called a monzu. This is a very revered person in Sicilian society. Describe a master chef to us.
Yes. Historically, at the beginning of the 19th century, it was fashionable among Sicilian aristocracy to import chefs from France. And they applied the French method to traditional Sicilian cuisine. And they produced this cuisine, which was incredibly refined and brilliant. Through the 19th century, this tradition continued using native-born Sicilians. And the original Frenchmen were called Monsieur, because they were French. But after a while, they started to call them Monsieur, because they were Sicilians. And they were like the bad boys of food. They played tricks on the people they worked for. They held back recipes. They held their recipes very close. They had a very playful relationship to the food and to the situation they were in. Because you have to understand, Sicily really was a feudal society till the end of the Second World War, when the great land reforms divested these enormous landholders of their land. So it really wasn't until those land reforms that the feudalism in Sicily truly broke up.
So how did your grandfather get to be a master chef?
Well, my grandfather was a young man from a very small town called Isnello, which is a little town in the Madonie Mountains in Sicily. And at 16, he walked to a small city called Polizzi Generosa, where he to seek his destiny. And he tried doing several things. For a while, he was apprenticed to a goldsmith. He tried several things, and a friend of his said that this baron was hiring day laborers because his daughter was getting married, and he was hiring people to work in the kitchen. And my grandfather became utterly fascinated by the whole process of cooking and begged the master to take him as a permanent apprentice.
And he did.
But then at a point, he really couldn't bear being under the heel of the baron or being under the heel of this aristocratic system. And he was young, early 30s, and he had no real family attachments. He was not yet married and so forth. And he moved to America to seek his fortune and he was fascinated by the great freedom across the sea.
So he went to Brucolino. You have a wonderful passage where you describe moving in, actually living with your parents after your father died. You and your mother moved in with your grandparents. And this great scene of you coming home from school and doing your homework at the kitchen table while your grandfather was cooking. Is that as nice an experience as it is an image?
Probably a better experience than the image itself. I would sit at one end of the table and do my homework, and he'd stand at the other and cooked. And I must tell you that I didn't know it at the time, but he was really giving me a rather formal education as a chef. We started with mise en place, which is putting things in their place, maintaining order in the kitchen. The first thing we ever cooked together when I was 7, the first thing we cooked was a frittata, or as the Sicilians call it, a frogia, as we call it, an omelette.
Right.
And when those eggs hit that hot oil and puffed, I was hooked. This was complete magic for me. Of this whole huge family, I'm the only person he chose to give this gift to.
Why you, do you think?
I don't know. We were together. My grandfather was paterfamilias for this giant extended family. And I was the last child in his life. Maybe that's why. I don't know.
What was his specialty?
He had several. Certainly his signature dish was this thing, which he called atumala. And tumala is named after the last emir of Catania, whose name was Ibn al-Tumna, from, I believe, the 10th century. And it is a layered rice dish, which over the years has been transformed into kind of a bomb mm-hmm. kind of affair. And what my grandfather's tumala was and is rice, which is cooked and mixed with eggs and pecorino cheese, and then formed against a rather large bowl. The center is then filled with pasta, which is tossed with a meat sauce. It's basically the meats from that sauce. And then the rice covers the top. This giant thing is baked and then demolded. So it looks sort of like a mountain on a plate. Probably a more original version of the famous timpano from Big Night. But the extraordinary thing about my grandfather's tumala is that it has a tremendous lightness about it, a kind of an airiness. And although, you know, here in the United States, we are very opposed to the notion of double starches, you know, double starches. It has this brilliant lightness about it.
And have you been able to duplicate your grandfather's recipe?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. I watched him make it often, and I have myself now been making it for some time, and I have. But I must tell you that I just always assumed that he cut it in slices. And last year, I found an old 8mm film, a home movie. And on this home movie was my grandfather cutting a tumala. And I always assumed that he just cut it in slices from top to bottom. And I see in this film that what he actually did is he would cut a slice and then cut that slice in half, halfway up, and then turn it over right side down on the plate. So I learned a whole new method for cutting the tumala from my grandfather, who has been dead now for 30 years, and he's still teaching me stuff.
Our guest is Vincent Schiavelli, and he's just written a book. It's a memoir, part recipe, part stories. It's called Brucolino, America, Remembrances of Sicilian-American Brooklyn Told in Stories and Recipes. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Vincent Schiavelli is our guest today, and he's just written a book. It's called Brucolino, America, Remembrances of Sicilian-American Brooklyn Told in Stories and Recipes. And Vincent Schiavelli is also an actor. Tell us how you first got interested in the theater, how you got introduced to acting and drama.
Well, I think, this is my theory, I grew up in this household in Brooklyn with these Sicilians. Drama was no stranger to us.
It was every day, right?
It was every day. And situations that called for high drama were certainly filled with it. Also, being the only child in a household of adults, I think at a very early age, I learned how to be different people. All of these adults wanted something different from me. And I don't mean this in a dysfunctional or really awful way. I mean it in the sweetest way you could possibly imagine. So I love to play pretend as a kid. I love to sort of imagine that I was someone else, perhaps someone on a jungle adventure or a private detective or any number of these kinds of things, you know? And I think I learned that I had this ability in me as a child.
Did the adults in your life encourage this play acting and pretending that you did? Is this something they encouraged?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they didn't join in, but they certainly encouraged it.
Well, I notice, looking at your film career, that you have had a long association with Milos Forman. In fact, your first film with him goes back to 1970, a film called Taking Off. How did you and Milos Forman hook up?
Milos and I met quite by accident. I was working on a student movie. A shot needed to be taken out of a window on a street in New York called St. Mark's Place of that street. The student film director climbed the stairs of the window he wanted to shoot from. And sitting in that apartment was Milos Forman.
Just coincidentally.
Yes. And a few months later, he gave a lecture at NYU's film school. And John Klein, who was the student, showed him the film. And he said, "It's a wonderful film. I love this film. I must meet everyone in this film." And I met Milos Forman the night of the Academy Awards in 1968, sitting in a hotel room at the Chelsea Hotel, sharing a Czech beer. And that's how he and I met.
Now, this movie, Taking Off, goes back to 1970. What was that about? And what part did you play?
Yes, it was a film about, it was a film with Buck Henry and Lynn Carlin. And it was a film about a young girl runs away from home and her parents. And she's not actually run away from home. She's gone to audition for a play. And her parents become crazed that she's gone and join this organization called the Society for Parents of Runaway Children. And through this organization, they end up at the small house party where I teach them how to smoke pot. The parents.
A big part you had or a little part?
It was about 15 minutes.
Right.
It was very droll. You know, this is a joint. You hold it like this. And it was very funny. And, of course, the parents all get stoned and then go back to somebody's house and proceed to get drunk and play strip poker.
I was rewatching Cuckoo's Nest, and you play a psychiatric patient in that movie. a fella named Fredrickson. You have almost no lines, but you have such an expressive face, and I was watching your eyes in particular, which look almost darkened, but the eyes really do so much of the acting for that character, at least it seems to me.
Well, you know, in real life, people don't make giant gestures. Also, if you're playing somebody who's a paranoid schizophrenic, you might not want to show people what you were thinking. So you might want to keep it more, you might want to hide it a little bit. But yet it can't help but come out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But you have to do a lot of work, I guess, behind the eyes somehow.
Yes. Yes. That film was an extraordinary circumstance, the shooting of that film. I mean, we'd go out to dinner at night, and Louise Fletcher, who played the big nurse, would say, "All right, now, Vincent, you sit here, and Danny, you sit here, and you sit here." And we'd say, "Okay." And we'd all take our seats that Louise directed us to.
So you were in character?
Yes, but we didn't really know it. I mean, it wasn't like a joke. It was the way it was. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. We worked all day, every day, 12 or 14 hours for 6 days a week. The hotel we were staying at never changed, you know. Sometimes I would take my clothes and just throw them all around the room just to have some effect on it. And I'd come back from work and the maid would have folded it all in neat piles again. But the place where we were shooting changed all the time. And that became more like home than the hotel where we were staying. It felt more like a home environment. And there were certain rules, certain hospital rules that we had established. For example, there was one rule that you couldn't bring a pillow from the dormitory into the day room. Everyone observed those rules. Hmm. Or if you wanted to take a nap in the afternoon and your bed was not available, you would actually ask the actor whose character's bed it was if it was okay if you'd like lie down on their bed. It created a very strong reality.
And do you think that's why the film is as good as it is, because of that intense reality of the
actors? Yes, because there's no acting in that movie. Everyone is being there. It became real clear during the rehearsal period that acting crazy was not going to do. You had to be who you would imagine yourself to be if you were crazy. The thing that we had to learn, all of us, was how to be hospitalized, because we didn't know what that was.
You have a really distinctive face. How has that face, you think, opened doors for you in the movie and theater world?
Well, everyone likes something that is unique. It has opened doors on one level. On another level, it hasn't opened doors. The world is not creative enough to have me play a leading man.
I was wondering about that.
Although I am the leading man of my life.
I understand that as well. But are there certain parts you don't get because of your face?
Sure. Sure, there's certain parts that I don't get because of my face and my physicality, but obviously there is certain reality here as well. And then there is things that are just cultural. So it has opened doors, and at the same time, it hasn't opened doors. But I tell you, being a character actor in the United States, there's one thing you get. You get lots of free time, and one can take that time and use it very profitably.
So you don't mind or resent the fact that perhaps people have typecast you in a very narrow way?
Yeah, I have played a variety of different parts. What is difficult is if I do a particularly good job in something, I then tend to not work for a while because people say, well, he was that ghost, and ghost, everyone has that image so strongly in their heads.
Right.
Instead of saying, I mean, what I'd like them to say is, well, he's a good actor. Look what he did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If he could do that, maybe he can do this. The head doesn't seem to go to that place. So that's a little disconcerting. But writing these books certainly is I can't disconnect the writing of Brucolino America from the fact that I am a character actor and do have this time.
Well, I know that you have just finished working on a Van Damme film. What yeah. kind of character do you play in that?
I play an Indian. I play Mr. Singh. I play Mr. Singh. I own the Bombay Cafe. Very lovely place, the Bombay Cafe. I play a cafe owner in this little town called Inferno that is being overrun by, you know, a motorcycle gang, drug manufacturer, radical right group. And, of course, Van Damme comes in and kind of straightens everybody out, and the townspeople rally behind him and pull their town back.
And you get to prevail along with Van Damme?
Bien sûr.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Actor and cook Vincent Schiavelli. His new book is Brucolino America, Remembrances of Sicilian-American Brooklyn Told in Stories and Recipes. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.